everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2025, and you're listening to episode 453, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Jurassic World Rebirth, now in theaters. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Man Creates Something Worse Than Dinosaurs, a review of Jurassic World Rebirth. And you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you back on the broadcast.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're covering the first of the various different summer blockbuster series in the movie theaters. And the first of that is the Jurassic World movie, and it's called Jurassic World Rebirth, and it's part of some of the series that started way back when, I think, based on books in the 1990s. So we are 30 years into this particular film franchise. So what is this Jurassic Park franchise about? And as I said at the beginning of this interview, but we'll reiterate again, this is going to be very spoiler filled. So if you are having a plans to see this film and don't want any spoilers, then you might as well put this one on pause and come back to it once you're done watching the film, because we are going to talk a lot about it. But give us the background on the entire Jurassic Park franchise.
So the Jurassic Park series is at its core this story about the collision of, let's say, human ambition and the natural world. It's this cautionary tale, if you will, that's dressed up in blockbuster spectacle that asks and plays with the question, what happens when humanity plays God? And this central idea, which is drawn from Michael Crichton's 1990 novel, is sort of deceptively simple. It's very much what you would call high concept, where scientists use genetic engineering to bring dinosaurs back to life and then lose control of them. Like, it's a very simple setup. It's interesting, but it's a simple setup. But thematically, the films explore, you know, hubris, the illusion of control, morality, the unintended consequences of scientific progress, unchecked, that kind of a thing. And the original film, Jurassic Park, released in 1993, directed by Steven Spielberg, was really a landmark moment for filmmaking as a whole. It was one of the first major films to use what they call CGI, or computer-generated imagery, in a way that was truly seamless. It married animatronics, which is a very old-fashioned style of movie making, where everything is built. Think of them as very, very expensive puppets. So it married animatronics and digital effects to create dinosaurs, recreations of dinosaurs that felt very, very real, and not just, you know, visually, but physically, and the way that the actors interacted with them on screen. And audiences really hadn't seen too much like that up to that point. And it was, you can sort of think of that 1993 film as a bit of a turning point for visual effects. And it set a new standard for filmmaking that filmmakers are still chasing even today. Beyond the tech, though, Jurassic Park was powerful as far as its story goes, because it was very mythic. It wasn't just a creature feature. It was a sort of modern fable. characters like, you know, Dr. Ian Malcolm, who so memorably played by Jeff Goldblum in the original, and Richard Attenborough's John Hammond, they weren't plot devices, and they weren't, you know, stock types. Stock types aren't bad, but they weren't just stock characters. They were stand-ins for competing worldviews, right? Caution versus optimism, ethics versus enterprise. And the dinosaurs weren't the villains. They were just sort of the thing that motivated the plot, the thing that the story was revolving around. But the human characters and their pride became the real villains of the series. And that original trilogy continued with The Lost World in 97 and Jurassic Park 3 in 2001. Spielberg had a hand in 97's The Lost World, directed it. They brought back Ian Malcolm. Jurassic Park 3 was a little different. These sequels expanded the world. They introduced new settings. They leaned into adventure, survival. And the philosophical edge softened somewhat. But the central tension of can humans contain what they create remained. The series was dormant for a little over a decade. Finally, in 2015, the franchise was revived with Jurassic World, and I anticipate that most listeners will be most familiar with this second trilogy of films. Jurassic World, directed by Colin Trevorrow, and this new trilogy really leaned into the commercialization of science, depicting a fully functioning dinosaur theme park, sort of the ultimate realization of what the original movie set out to do, complete with, you know, these corporate sponsorships and engineered hybrids, like the, you know, the infamous Indominus Rex from Jurassic World. The films became much louder, more action-oriented, more self-aware, which is a hallmark of storytelling in the 21st century, very self-aware stories. And they sort of openly embraced their role as blockbuster entertainment. But they continued to gesture toward, you know, the ethical dilemmas at the core of the franchise and the more interesting material. The sequel to Jurassic World was Fallen Kingdom, which came out in 2018, I think. And then the last film of that trilogy was subtitled Dominion. Both of those films escalated those themes, and it all sort of culminated in a world where dinosaurs now roamed freely alongside humanity. They were brought back and reintroduced into the world's ecosystem. But with each entry, the series, it also reflected evolving cultural anxieties, anxieties about corporate power, anxieties about ecological collapse, the ethics of genetic manipulation. All of those ideas were sort of front and center in the last trilogy. And that, you know, brings us up to this year's Jurassic World Rebirth, which I would say in some ways acts as sort of a thematic bookend to the original. It sort of strips away some of the bombast that came in with the last trilogy to return to some of those moral questions that launched the franchise. What does it mean to create life? What happens when that creation goes awry? How do you live with the consequences? So to answer plainly, Jurassic Park is about, I guess you could say, the thrill of discovery and the terror that follows when we refuse to recognize our limits. It's a story that keeps evolving, but it always sort of comes back to the same idea that nature, in a sense, is not humanity's to command. And when humanity tries to do that, the results are rarely what they expect, and it often goes out of their control. So that's just a look at what the Jurassic Park series is about.
Before I get into more questions about the series and this film, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are wondering, you know, this has a PG-13 rating. So can Christians comfortably watch this film, and could they say take their teenagers or middle school kids to see this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Christians can comfortably watch the new film, but thoughtfully. I, you know, when I get back to the school that I teach at, during the school year. Of all the films that will come out this summer, Fantastic Four, Superman, Jurassic World, Rebirth, this will be the film the kids come in talking about. So I think it's, and we're talking, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade students, high schoolers. So it's, yeah, I think they will be able to see it. There's no overt content that I think would disqualify it in terms of language or sexuality. It's violent, yes, but there's a context, right? In a way that serves as a cautionary message. The horror elements are real, and some of the imagery is unsettling, which has been true of this entire series from 1993 on. But the film never feels particularly gratuitous. In fact, it's sort of morally serious in a way that some blockbusters just aren't. So I would say for Christians, they can comfortably watch the new film. It's an opportunity to think about, you know, for the cultural apologists, talk about these different themes of creation, the dangers of technological pride, that sort of a thing.
And it seems to me it would really appeal to, I did see the film in the theater, and there were a lot of younger kids, middle school and high school there. So it seems, you know, it's the summer, so they were there at a matinee, but it seems to me that it would appeal to kids, even despite the fact that it's not like a high tech type of, or superhero kind of film.
So the plan is this summer, we'll look at a few of these blockbusters, Superman, Fantastic Four, the other big ones that are coming out. And my prediction right now, I'm happy to be wrong about this, but my suspicion is that Jurassic World is going to do far better than anyone is anticipating, even with two major superhero films coming out in the same month as the Jurassic World film, for exactly the reason that you've said. Dinosaurs sell. Dinosaurs attract people for whatever reason, especially younger audiences, more so than Superman, more so than Fantastic Four. This movie is going to hold its own at the box office. Again, even when faced with the Superman film, even when faced with another major Marvel film, this movie will do just fine. Probably better than people are anticipating because dinosaurs appeal to children.
So just to talk a little bit more about the franchise itself, it's one of the major franchises going on right now. And our listeners will have heard our recap of the Mission Impossible end to that franchise. And so the movies are pretty much, you know, really solid at the box office in terms of what is expected. And as a matter of fact, I think that Jurassic World came in quite a bit, I don't know if it was higher than they thought it was, but it's already, as of our recording, made more than $300 million at the worldwide box office, and about $150 million of half of that in the United States. So it is something that is quite popular, I think, in terms of a box office hit when people are going to the movies less and less. And, you know, it's obviously, this is the seventh film, so it's not as many as Marvel or the James Bond films going back many decades. But what about this particular theme and the series do you think endures, that audiences are attracted to it?
Yeah, I think the, just talking numbers very quickly, the new film, all of the projections I saw, everybody expected to do pretty well, but it outperformed expectations by about $50 million. Just on opening weekend. So after the first few days, you started to see all of the projection outlets adjusting their numbers to be higher. And ultimately it did just across, you know, 4th of July weekend. I think it was like the best 4th of July weekend run in 5 years or something like that at the box office. So it outperformed to the tune of $50 million, which is nothing to laugh at. The Jurassic Park series, it's, you know, it's one of those rare cinematic ecosystems that just keeps on thriving no matter what critics say. The last film, Dominion, is a perfect example. We were sort of talking about this before this podcast. It was widely panned for its, you know, this very bloated plot. It has a ton of main characters, something in the ballpark of, I think, six main characters that the movie sort of has to follow and give screen time to. It has incredibly uneven pacing, and yet it pulled in $1 billion globally. So when the question is, why do these films endure? It is not that these movies just sort of, you know, come lumbering back into theaters every few years and a few people see them. It's sort of a cinematic oddity today to have a film so widely panned, especially today where critical reviews do in fact matter. Maybe more so than even in the past because of things like Rotten Tomatoes. We've talked about this on this podcast before. When I have a very distinct memory of the day that I think I was in a Walmart, and I saw on the cover of a DVD that stupid little tomato that said, you know, certified fresh, as if it's like giving me permission to like this movie, to buy this movie. And I remember seeing that and hating the idea that, you know, we're really going to use this image of a tomato to tell people, okay, it's okay to like this movie. The world has said it's okay to like this movie. It's a good movie universally, that kind of stuff. It's nonsense to me. These are films that defy that. These are films that sometimes have shockingly bad reviews that still make $1 billion at the box office. So the question is why? Why do these films endure, and why are they sometimes underestimated? And I think, you know, beyond just the what we've talked about, the appeal of dinosaurs and that sort of a thing, which we can go into more later. But beyond that, I think the core idea still works. The premise is incredibly clean and universal. Humans bring back dinosaurs, and it goes really, really wrong. It's a concept that really doesn't need much explaining, but it resonates across cultures, across generations. If the story changes, even if the story changes, the foundation holds. And that's one of the reasons it's so critic-proof. It delivers on a primal level. And then, as we said, dinosaurs themselves are a kind of cinematic cheat code. They appeal to everyone, but especially to kids. And there's this sort of built-in sense of wonder and terror that no amount of weak dialogue or convoluted subplots can completely dilute. People don't really go to these movies to watch a story. You know what I mean? They go to see something massive and ancient come to life with very good visual effects. And, you know, regardless of the narrative and the characters and all of that kind of stuff, the franchise knows how to deliver those visual moments in a way that sticks with people. And it has done that pretty consistently since 1993. There's also, and it bears worth pointing out, a nostalgia factor that shouldn't be underestimated. The original Jurassic Park, as we said, is a cultural landmark for many people, especially millennials, Gen Xers. It was their first brush with movie magic on a grand scale. So every new installment becomes a kind of pilgrimage back to that experience. Maybe some, you know, a lot of people feel like they owe it to themselves to see the next Jurassic Park film. And I think that's especially true because there was such a dearth of these movies for about a 10, 15 year period in between Jurassic Park 3 and Jurassic World, which was another movie that came out of nowhere and absolutely, you know, did fantastic at the box office. So even when these films stumble creatively, the audience connection to them remains very strong. And, you know, I think the reason these films are sometimes underestimated is because they walk a line between serious themes and blockbuster spectacle. Critics are an interesting bunch. Critics often look for innovation or subversion. This is why you will see, you know, amazing critical reviews for The Last Jedi and these horrendous audience scores. I mean, I can safely say, despite the fact that The Last Jedi receives, you know, such accolades on a critical scale, there are very few people, I mean, can count them on one hand, that I have ever met and talked to who is like, oh yeah, I love The Last Jedi. I mean, I can safely say most of the people that I have met hate that film with a a primal level of can't stand to watch it again, will never watch it again, ruin Star Wars single-handedly, that kind of stuff. So critics often look for innovation or subversion with these big franchise movies. But the Jurassic films tend to reassert familiar patterns. Nature bites back, humans pay for their pride, the dinosaurs rule the screen, that kind of a thing. That repetition can feel safe or formulaic among critics. But to a global audience, it comes across as, you know, mythic. And that's part of the appeal. These stories don't need to reinvent themselves every time. They just need to be exactly what audiences want them to be. They just need to remind people in very spectacular fashion that they're not in charge, and to do that through dinosaurs. So yeah, it's a franchise that might not always impress critics, but it continues to draw massive crowds because it taps into awe and fear and nostalgia and spectacle all at once. And that's a winning combination that is really difficult to dismiss.
I hope you have our other podcasts, Christian Research Journal Reads, into your podcast feed, because we have so many different varieties of articles that are really popular on our website that we've made available to you as audio versions. And it's a great way to catch up on articles you might have missed over the years. You know, the Christian Research Journal has been around for almost 50 years. And so we have so many resources, written resources, as well as different audio resources now, and we are heading towards 120 episodes of the Christian Research Journal Read. So it's a lot of articles there for you as you commute or work out or walk your dog or whatever it may be when you listen to your podcast. So thanks for connecting with us there wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And don't forget to go to equip.org. Now you know that's where you're going to find the article that's related to this interview today with Cole Burgett, but also articles over the last almost 50 years, as I said, of journal articles that are a wealth of information. And the really cool thing about our website is CRI is not under a paywall. It is completely free. And we used to be a paid subscription. So please take advantage of all the resources there. We have resources from the Hank Unplugged podcast and the Bible Answer Man. And you can partner there with us as well by giving us a tip. If you happen to be on the Postmodern Realities podcast section of the website, just hit journal and you can see we have Christian articles, Postmodern Realities podcast, Christian Research Journal Reads, etc. And if you click on any one of those landing pages, then you will be able to find the link where you could give us a tip. So we would be grateful for that. And now back to my conversation about the Jurassic Park world, different films for the last 30 years with Cole Burgett.
So we were at the beginning of the podcast, you were talking, just touching on some of the films, the original film, the first one, and the book it was based on in the early 90s, some of those themes, and you mentioned that they were mythic. So because of that, do you think that Christians can find a value in the Jurassic Park series?
Absolutely, and not just value, but relevance. This series is a modern myth that really, in some sense, maps remarkably well onto a biblical framework, especially when it comes to the nature of creation, human limitation, moral responsibility, that sort of a thing. From a Christian perspective, the central conflict in these films is theological before it's scientific. It's about what happens when man rejects his role as steward and instead reaches, you know, for the role of creator. In Genesis, humanity is charged with the stewardship of the garden. But in Jurassic Park, that responsibility is thrown out the window. Life becomes something to manipulate, to monetize, to control. And that shift, right, from stewardship to domination is sort of exactly what Paul describes in Romans chapter 1, when he's talking about people exchanging the truth of God for a lie, becoming futile, dark, vain in their thinking. The result is deformation, not just moral confusion, but the unraveling of identity, the unraveling of purpose. And, you know, the dinosaurs in that sense aren't just creatures, but are their consequences. They represent what happens when people tamper with boundaries they were never meant to cross. It's that old idea that we've talked about on this podcast before in different capacities of forbidden knowledge. There are certain things humanity is just not meant to know. There are certain areas humanity is just not meant to tap into. And it's the Promethean story all over again. It's Frankenstein all over again. The destruction that then follows isn't random. It is a kind of poetic justice. Nature in the Jurassic Park films, it does not cooperate with human hubris. Once the reach exceeds the grasp, there are consequences, natural consequences. For Christians, this raises a very rich apologetic question. You know, what is the source of moral limits? Why do we instinctively feel that some lines shouldn't be crossed? Why is it that when, you know, these characters in this new film are, you know, they're on this island, they're running from these dinosaurs, and then they find this lab where these experiments are being carried out on these different dinosaurs, and you're looking at these mutations, you're looking at these monsters, these things that just look unnatural. You know that something has gone awry, something has gone wrong. What does it say about us that we're so drawn to stories where humanity gets punished for overreaching? Why do we keep telling the story of Prometheus over and over and over? Why do we keep telling the story of Frankenstein over and over and over? What is the connection between these stories and monsters? Whether those monsters are the D-Rex in this new film, this you know, hybrid genetic mutation gone awry, or whether it's just a good old-fashioned T-Rex in the original Jurassic Park. What is the connection there between the monstrous and these kinds of stories? These are questions that naturally lead into conversations about creation, fall, redemption, the biblical arc, not Noah's Ark, but the arc of the biblical story. So while Jurassic Park may not be an overtly Christian story, it operates within a moral framework that resonates with Christian theology. It's just an example of a major franchise that entertains while also inviting serious reflection about what it means to be human in a world that we didn't make. And I think that's also part of its appeal, to go back to that question. Part of the appeal is it's not just mythic in terms of iconography, because you don't really have a ton of archetypes in these movies. You can argue that there's some sense of an archetype that has been created for a Jurassic Park hero. But by and large, the story itself is mythic. It is not just, you know, using familiar characters and icons. It is in fact telling a story that reinforces mythic themes that we have seen for thousands and thousands of years.
So we talked a little bit earlier, you thought that this movie would be popular with kids. And I did say, you know, we're briefly prepping before we started this podcast, that I felt like this had some of the similar beats as the very first film, where children are in danger from these monsters, these dinosaurs, and it is, you know, rated PG-13. There's like no nudity or anything like that. It's kind of like the horror jump scare moments. But is this okay? You thought it would be okay for middle school and high schoolers to watch. What should there be? Anything else that Christian parents know about this kind of a horror theme where they're confronted with these very terrifying, I think they were like hybrid dinosaurs?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the child. The first film in particular is intense. I wouldn't say that it's gory, but it is suspenseful and psychologically frightening at times. And the imagery really, really sticks with you. Children being hunted, people being eaten, that kind of a thing. In that respect, while the series is rated PG-13, that rating really does cover a lot of ground. I'd say it's not appropriate for younger kids. Having said that, though, I do have a very young niece and nephew, and the nephew is all about dinos right now. That's sort of his thing. And every chance he gets, if you know the YouTube is on the TV, if a clip from Jurassic World Rebirth pops up, you know, he's all about that, and he's 3 years old, and he's just drawn to that. So I'd say, even though it's not appropriate for younger kids, it certainly holds an appeal to that age group. So parents need to watch the films first and make a judgment call based on their child's sensitivity to fear, you know, not just violence. So thematically, yeah, the movies raise valuable questions, but they are wrapped in genuine peril. So discernment is key when watching these films.
So I want to talk in particular about this new film, the seventh film, which is Jurassic World Rebirth. How is it different than the other stories, all the six films before them, maybe some of the more recent ones? And who are the major characters in this particular film?
Rebirth picks up about 5 years after the end of the last film, which was called Dominion. At the end of Dominion, we were left with this fairly large and chaotic setup. Dinosaurs roaming freely in the modern world and humans trying to adapt to this new environment. But perhaps unexpectedly, Rebirth doesn't really continue that global storyline. Instead, it pulls the focus in tight again. Back to an island, back to a smaller group of characters, and back to a more intimate, more suspense-driven setting. And in a lot of ways, I see a lot of stuff online calling it a soft reboot or something like that. I think it's worth pointing out that the writer of the film, David Coet, has made it a point to say that this is not a reboot. That he doesn't really like reboots. He doesn't like when films pretend as though that what happened previously never happened. So you'll find in the first 30 minutes of this movie, a lot of, it's very talky. It's surprisingly talky, and it's very character heavy, which is a bit of a departure from the last three movies. But the first 30 minutes of this movie does a lot of ground covering in terms of explaining why what is happening. And there's a lot of, I guess what you could say, science or pseudoscience. I'm not an expert in these things. I don't know if it's accurate. I'm assuming it's probably accurate enough to pass the sniff test. But other than that, it's all just made up. But the idea is that the climate of the world today has changed so much since the time that dinosaurs were around that the dinosaurs that are now in the world are now dying off. They cannot adapt to the climate. And so in order to sort of save them, those that can be rescued and have been rescued have been taken to this island or chain of islands near the equator because the climate there is very similar to what it used to be. And the story proper centers on this character, Zora Bennett, played by Scarlett Johansson. And she's a covert ops specialist who has been hired by a biotech firm to retrieve genetic samples from the last surviving specimens of three major dinosaur species. And again, this is where there's a lot of, you know, technobabble thrown in there explaining that, you know, the larger these dinosaurs are, something about the more intense their, you know, they're bigger samples for their hearts. They're basically trying to cure heart disease. They think that if you can get some samples from these three huge dinosaurs, because of their size, the way that their bodies regulate their hearts or heart regulates their bodies, whatever, there's something to that. There's something beneficial in the realm of medicine there. And so that she's basically this person who is hired by this firm that's, you know, got this idea of trying to find a cure for heart disease to go to this island and retrieve these samples from these dinosaurs. So it's sort of it's a bit of an involved setup, if you will. Now, the island she's sent to was once part of Engine's network of research facilities. So if you remember the first films, the early films, Engine was John Hammond's company that was responsible for the first park, that was responsible for first bringing the dinosaurs back by, you know, using the DNA extracted from this mosquito that was found encased in amber. And these labs that they're finding on this island are kind of like these off-the-books labs that were supposedly abandoned after the events of the earlier films. And what they end up finding on this island isn't just surviving dinosaurs. They also find the remnants of these past experiments. Creatures that aren't just clone dinosaurs, but twisted genetic hybrids that had been left to evolve in isolation. So we're talking about things like, the new face of this movie, the Distortus Rex, this what they call the D-Rex, this six-limbed, highly unstable giant predator, and these, you know, winged creatures called mutadons. These aren't natural dinosaurs. They're the results of forgotten, buried experiments, and they've been adapting to this climate that they're in. So there's also a human element to the story besides, you know, the shady corporate dinosaur drama. Zora's team ends up rescuing this family that gets stranded near the island, adding this emotional through line and a bit of grounded tension. So the film becomes this blend of survival horror, ethical reckoning, and creature feature chaos, but told on a smaller, more focused scale than the last few installments. So while it's technically part of the 2015, you know, expanded, updated continuity, Rebirth feels a bit like a spiritual successor to Jurassic Park. It's a bit of a return to the tone of that original film, with maybe a bit more of a horror edge, a bit more cynicism to it. So that's what's going on in this new film.
You said that it's not a throwback or it's not like a reboot, but to me, Rebirth had this kind of vibe of Indiana Jones a little bit. How does this particular film balance, like, you know, the OG that you were talking about, the first movie, the feel of that, but maybe just something for more modern audiences 30 years down the line from when the series started?
Yeah, it's not, like we said, not so much a reboot as it is a spiritual successor, a kind of throwback, if you will, to the original. And it really does walk a kind of tightrope between nostalgia and then reinvention. It brings back the tone and structure of the original Jurassic Park, this remote location, small group of people, dinosaurs reasserting themselves. But it doesn't really rehash what we've seen before so much as it uses the original film's DNA and then, you know, fittingly mutates it, given the subject matter. You noted that it sort of almost has an Indiana Jones feel to it. I think what this is actually something I commented to one of my friends who saw the film. We were talking about it after we both saw it. And I said, it one of the things I liked about it is that it has this classic adventure movie feel to it. Instead of going bigger, like for example, with Dominion, that's a very strange movie. It has almost like spy movie elements in it. And it sort of is about a lot of these characters just running around this corporate lab with a lot of sort of almost like just, I go to the word corporate, but that's the idea. It's sort of like this business tone to it. You've got Goldblum and, you know, Sam Neill and Laura Dern, and they're sort of engaged in this corporate cloak and dagger type thing. It was sort of an odd movie. And this film doesn't go in that direction. Rebirth goes towards something more classic, towards something more adventuresome. And you get a sense of Jaws. You get a sense of the African Queen. You get a sense of these classic jungle adventure movies. And I for one like that because I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. If you show me give me a bunch of people wandering around a jungle and I'm there. And this movie certainly has that. I think one of the ways that Rebirth pulls off that balancing what we've seen before and then doing something different is by scaling down. You get this globe-trotting chaos with Dominion and the Jurassic World films. But this film feels very grounded. There's no sprawling international storylines or, you know, multiple six different characters you're trying to keep up with at one point in time. There's a very small core group of characters who are mostly together. It's one island. It's one mission. There's a B plot that follows a family, but they intersect pretty heavily with the first storyline. And it's this slow build of tension. And that structure immediately recalls Spielberg's approach. Set up the environment, let the suspense grow, and then let things spiral. At the same time, Rebirth pushes the franchise's themes into a darker territory. I couldn't help but thinking as I was sitting there watching this film, and I think I note this maybe in the review I wrote, but one of the things I kept coming back to when watching it was there's a way in which this movie pays dividends to some of the dialogue that Ian Malcolm had in the first film. You know, Ian Malcolm, and I'm assuming most everyone's familiar with this, Ian Malcolm, of course, is the character played by Jeff Goldblum, very iconic in the first film, was the star of The Lost World and came back in the Jurassic World, The Last Trilogy. He is a character who is a chaos theorist, and he's sort of brought in very early on to give his thoughts on this this new venture called Jurassic Park. And he's sort of the guy who is very loudly against this because there's no way to actually control the kind of stuff that the scientists are tapping into. And he, you know, very famously has some classic lines from the first movie. He has a tit for tat exchange with John Hammond, who's the guy responsible for bringing the dinosaurs back. But one of the things that Malcolm is adamant about is that once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's really hard to put it back in again. And in Rebirth, it's this movie is not just about dinosaurs. The first one was. What Rebirth is about is what has gone on in the shadows while the world was distracted by the dinosaurs. And it's very cynical in that way. But again, I think it pays dividends on what Malcolm was warning about in that first film, where, you know, of course there would be people who would come along who would never be content with just having a dinosaur or playing around with dinosaurs or something like that. And you started to see seeds of this back in Jurassic World, right? When they began doing like dinosaur hybrids for the sake of, you know, trying to make more money. But here in this one, what you see are these creatures that aren't majestic. They're wrong. They're these failed experiments, which means that the moral and philosophical weight of the story is heavier than it's been in a hot minute. It's no longer a question of should we bring dinosaurs back? It's what have we made in the process? And what does that say about us? So we've sort of gone beyond the idea of just fooling around with dinosaurs, even though there are plenty of dinosaurs in this film and they all, you know, have moments to shine. The third act of this movie is really about what has gone on in the background. What have these people been doing in trying to screw around with dinosaur DNA to build something new and it blowing up in their face and them having created monsters in the process? Visually and tonally, this film leans into a more horror-inflected style. One of the most noticeable things about the Jurassic World films, and probably what made them so much money at the box office, is that they sort of went in the direction of louder, more action horror. The suspenseful horror elements are still there, but they were sort of loud, and the heroes were true heroes, and they're, you know, they're running around and they're riding motorcycles and all of that kind of stuff. This film is not that. It leans into a more Spielbergian style, and this is all very intentional. Gareth Edwards has talked at length about intentionally channeling Spielberg. But the lighting is moodier. The pacing is slower at first. The score even pulls from John Williams' original cues. So it sort of honors the original film without mimicking it. There's no Alan Grant. There's no Ellie Sattler. But there is a sense of moral consequence that puts the franchise, I think what many people would call, back into its proper thematic lane. So in a way, I would say Rebirth really succeeds because it remembers what Jurassic Park is about, not just dinosaurs, but limits. It brings back that fear of the unknown and then updates it for a world where scientific sins are no longer theoretical. They're embodied, they're monstrous, and they're out there. And this film is interested in playing in that territory.
So are there any other themes that this particular film, Rebirth, expands on that the original series started? Kind of, it to me, it got rid of a lot of the plot points that seemed really convoluted about the different corporations that were trying to open the theme park, because it's no longer about a theme park in this final film.
Yeah, it's...
Well, I don't know it's a final film, let me just say.
Right.
In the new film.
Yeah, it's sort of a perfect jumping on point for anybody who is, you know, missed the series or hasn't really watched the series at that point. You could watch this movie and still get the themes of the original. But if you are someone who has watched these movies all the way through, in a sense, I think, and I may have said this at the beginning, it feels a bit like a culmination. At least it did to me. It felt a bit like a culmination rather than just another entry in the series, right? In the original Jurassic Park, like we said, Malcolm functioned as this moral compass, this prophet in the wilderness, if you will. He's the one warning that life finds a way, you can't control nature, and that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And for the most part, the first film validated that perspective. Things fall apart, we're left with the impression that human arrogance had limits, and that those limits would be enforced by reality itself. But the sequels didn't always know what to do with that idea. They repeated the pattern, more dinosaurs, more chaos, but the philosophical weight got diluted under the spectacle. Then Rebirth comes along and says, okay, what if we took Malcolm seriously? What if we really followed his warnings to the end? What if we saw not just the collapse of a park, but the collapse of the idea that humans could ever master what they create at all? In Rebirth, we see that unchecked ambition running quite literally. The creatures aren't just dinosaurs anymore. Like we said, they're hybrids, evolutionary mistakes, designed in labs, abandoned when they prove too unstable or unprofitable. They're not wonders of science. And that's sort of the theological turn the film takes. It's not just about failure of control. It's about the deformation, the monsters that are created when creation is severed from its purpose. In a sense, Malcolm's warnings in that original film have metastasized. The moral decay that began with cloning dinosaurs has deepened into something much darker, tampering not just with life, but with what life is for. In Rebirth, it's not just that man is playing God. It's that man has forgotten what God even is, forgotten the creator, and therefore lost the meaning of creation. So when I say Rebirth is sort of a culmination of these ideas, these, you know, the series themes, I mean, it shows us what happens when a civilization keeps ignoring the moral warnings and pushes forward anyway. The monsters in the film are terrifying, not just because of their teeth, but because they are reflections of human ambition, recklessness, the refusal to submit to limits. In a sense, they're a kind of physical embodiment of futile thinking, as Paul puts it in Romans. They are what progress looks like when it loses its moral anchor. And that's, you know, what these Jurassic Park movies do so well, is they sort of say, this is what comes next when you don't listen. They're sort of a warning in that way. So I very comfortably would be fine with saying, you know, the Jurassic Park series lasted for 6 films. The 7th film is a little epilogue that shows us what happens after the last movie. Though I think that the truth is these movies make so much money, there's not going to be an end in sight for a while. So we'll just have to wait for the next one to see where the story goes.
Well, finally, a fun question that I have for Cole is, after this discussion about all the different Jurassic Park movies from the last 30 years, this is the 7th one. Which is your favorite, if you had a favorite, or you wouldn't mind watching again, I guess I could say.
Yeah, it's a toss up between the first one and The Lost World. I really like that original Jurassic Park and The Lost World. I like both of those.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast, and we'll see you soon for the next blockbuster.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 453 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written a film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Man Creates Something Worse Than Dinosaurs, a review of Jurassic World Rebirth. You can read it for free at equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.